Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. Randall White is off this week. I'm Pamela Wu, sitting in for him today. On today's Insight, we'll take a look at the outcome of the Senate impeachment trial against former President Donald Trump and what it means for our constitutional government and both political parties moving forward. We're starting today's show with a report on some campaign donations received by Governor Gavin Newsom. CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd joins us now. Scott took a deep dive into donations made to Governor Newsom during the 2018 campaign and for his upcoming reelection effort. Scott, good morning. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Pamela.
Well, what prompted you to take a closer look at certain campaign contributions?
Well, I've been following contracts that were awarded during the coronavirus pandemic, really now close to about a year. And there's a lot of money going around, and a lot of these contracts are emergency contracts or no-bid contracts, and those often deserve some scrutiny. And so the first place I thought to look was into contributions that were made to Governor Newsom, because he's been directly involved in, obviously, the government response to the pandemic, but also directly involved in working with some of these companies in terms of how they've been partnering with the state during the response.
So in your research, what did you find that you felt was noteworthy?
So I think it's important to state at the top here, and I'll probably say it maybe one or two other times because it's very important. You know, I found no evidence of broken laws, no quid pro quos, and government ethics experts agree with that. And the governor denies any wrongdoing, as do any of the companies that I found that I looked at as well. But there were at least four instances of major contributors who gave money in the months leading up to, and in most cases after, receiving no bid contracts. And we're talking contributions of, you know, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars to Newsom and his ballot measure committee. And some of these contracts were anywhere from $2 million up to, you know, over $1 billion. And again, these were no bid contracts. And so I spoke to government ethics experts, and they said that this raises major red flags. I spoke to Bob Stern. He's the former general counsel for the Fair Political Practices Commission here in California. And he also co-authored the State Political Reform Act. This is what he had to say.
I really think that the governor has a tin ear in terms of receiving huge campaign contributions and providing sole source contracts for corporations that were giving him these contributions. I assume that he thought nobody would do any research on this, that nobody would look at it, and that nobody would care. But I care. People want to make sure the governor and the state are making decisions that are solely based on the merits as opposed to any indication that it might be based on campaign contributions coming in.
And so, again, government ethics experts saying, you know, this is really about making the governor should have been a little more forthright about these contributions that were coming in and lining up with some of these contracts. And again, anytime no bid contracts are handed out, that deserves some scrutiny.
For those who aren't familiar with the world of government contracts, would you explain what a no-bid contract is?
Sure. So a no-bid contract is typically handed out when something is urgent, some sort of need for the government is immediate. And in this case, during the pandemic, there have been a number of those instances. And a no-bid contract means that there isn't a bidding process. It doesn't go out to a number of companies to say, hey, we have this need. How do you propose that you would solve it? The state essentially says, hey, this company here, we know you can do the job. Here's X amount of money. Let's execute the contract and get it going. And during the pandemic, the governor has had broad latitude to enter into these contracts since we're in such an urgent moment right now.
Right. And so notably different from the normal contract process. This was different because of the pandemic.
Exactly. And these contracts will come up in non-pandemic times. Sometimes, for example, during wildfires, that's another example when they may come up, but definitely different than the traditional process. And so the traditional process can take weeks, sometimes months to go through. It can be a lengthy process because the state wants to make sure that they're getting the best deal possible for, you know, taxpayer money. They want to make sure that the company is going to be as efficient as possible and that they have a good track record. But again, they also want to make sure that there's, you know, any avoidance of favoritism or even appearance of favoritism. So there's this very rigorous process to go through bidding to make sure that the company is the best company to do the job, but also there isn't a conflict or even appearance of conflict of interest. And another government ethics expert I spoke to, his name is Dan Schnur. He's a professor at USC and UC Berkeley. He told me, you know, a lot of this may come down to optics, but it's really important optics. Again, even though there's no evidence of wrongdoing from Governor Newsom, the Californians really deserve to know if there's an overlap here between contributors and folks getting these contracts and what that means. This is what he had to say.
The best rule for public officials at any level of either party is, when in doubt, err on the side of disclosure. And when it comes to a no bid contract, err on the side of disclosure even more. And when it comes to awarding a no bid contract to a past or present campaign contributor, err on the side of disclosure even more than that. I don't think it's fair to assume any impropriety. But when an elected official provides these types of opportunities to past and present donors, they do have an obligation to provide an explanation for that decision.
So, Scott, what are these contracts for and how much are they worth?
I'll give two examples. One much bigger, one a little bit on the smaller side, though still notable. United Health is a major healthcare company. In December of 2019, they contributed $31,000 to Governor Newsom's reelection campaign. Several months later, in April, a subsidiary of the company received a $100 million no-bid contract to expand testing in California. And that was later increased to $177 million. Between August and October, the company and its subsidiaries also received $300 million in contracts, though it did go through a kind of expedited bidding process. It wasn't quite no-bid. And in December, just a couple months ago, the company contributed $31,000 directly to Newsom's reelection campaign and $100,000 to Newsom's ballot measure committee. So you're seeing there again tens of thousands of dollars in the months leading up to these contracts, and in this case, over $100,000 after the contracts have been executed. I'll give one more quickly. In December of 2019, a company called Bloom Energy, which is a green tech company, they produce fuel cells. They contributed $31,000 to Newsom. That was December 2019. Just a few months later, they received a $1 million no-bid contract that was later increased to $2 million to refurbish ventilators for the state. Obviously, that's important equipment during the pandemic. Months later, in October, they contributed another $25,000 to Newsom. And so it's important to state these companies deny any wrongdoing. They say that their work with the state had nothing to do with their contributions. It wasn't meant for influence. But again, those are two examples of contributions lining up before and after these no bid contracts went out.
Anyone who wants to see these contracts can. The state has released information on the contracts that it entered as part of the pandemic response. These are contracts for $250,000 or more. It's right there on the state's COVID-19 site. What did you find when looking through that list? Were there other major contracts that stood out to you?
So it definitely is worth noting that after the state entered into a contract with a company called BYD, which was a somewhat controversial contract for close to $1 billion, that they didn't release initially, there was some pushback and the state said, you know, we're going to, in an effort to increase transparency, put these contracts out. So they did make that effort. And that was what I used to sort of compare with contributions to Governor Newsom. And there are, over 100 contracts out there on the site that are worth over $250,000. And it's worth noting that the vast majority of these, there is not an overlap that I saw between these companies, these contracts, and contributors to Governor Newsom. So I think that's really important to point out. That said, I brought those findings to government ethics experts, and they said, even if that's the case, you know, the proportionality of it, that doesn't really matter as much, even if there is still a trend, so to speak. If there are even a handful of these examples, that's still notable.
I'm talking with Scott Rodd, Cap Radio's state government reporter, about no-bid contracts awarded by the state as part of its pandemic response. Scott, you've quoted a couple of government ethics experts who say this is not necessarily about wrongdoing, rather it's about optics, but still important optics. I'm wondering what else the government ethics experts are saying.
So, you know, they're saying that any time that a NOBID contract is handed out, it deserves scrutiny. But they're also, you know, I asked them about what does this mean for the recall effort, because that's obviously top of mind for the governor. Folks in California are paying closer and closer attention to it as this recall effort has been gaining steam. And it's looking like they have a decent shot at gaining enough signatures to get this on the ballot. And they were split. One ethics expert said, you know, this is frankly going to be red meat for them. This is they're going to be all over this, and this really does not look good for Newsom. The other expert I spoke to said, well, you know, it may seem like a big deal, but ultimately it depends on if wrongdoing can be proven. I went to the recall folks themselves and I said, hey, what do you think of this? And I spoke to a man named Mike Netter. He is one of the leaders in the effort for the recall. Here's what he said.
Gavin Newsom is awarding contracts based on influence. Gavin Newsom is showing whether or not it's ethical or unethical, he's making poor decisions. This is a really bad look to the people of California that expect honesty and transparency from their government.
And they say that this is part of a trend and kind of a portrait that they've been painting of Newsom, where they feel that there hasn't been transparency, there hasn't been honesty coming from his office.
So we've heard then from ethics experts and now from the governor's political opponents. What is the governor's office saying?
So the governor's office emailed me a statement. I'm going to read. I'm going to read at least part of it here directly. Quote, the governor's administration made the decision to enter into all contracts related to COVID-19 response based on the best interest of the state in protecting health and welfare of all our residents. And, you know, Newsom's office says his office says that the governor had to work quickly to acquire life-saving equipment and life-saving services at the start of this pandemic. And that political contributions did not factor into his decision making at all. So they were unequivocal about that. So they completely deny that there's any sort of impact, influence, or crossover between the two.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio's state government reporter. Scott, thanks for joining us today on Insight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still to come, a closer look at the outcome of the unprecedented second impeachment trial against former President Donald Trump and what happens next. In for Randall White today, I'm Pamela Wu. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Randall White. Former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial ended with an acquittal in the Senate over the weekend. An ABC News Ipsos poll released on Monday showed that nearly 60% of Americans believe the former president should have been convicted. The trial saw House managers present dramatic footage of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Trump's lawyer, Bruce Castor, the former district attorney of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, admitted that he was forced to switch tactics.
I'll be quite frank with you. We changed what we were going to do on account that we thought that the House manager's presentation was well done.
Castor went on to say that the defense team had counterarguments to what the House managers presented and that they would be shared later on in the trial. He continued with this.
I thought that what the first part of the case was, which was the equivalent of a motion to dismiss, was going to be about jurisdiction alone.
Joining us now to unpack everything that went on as the impeachment trial wrapped up is Leslie Gilo Jacobs. She's the Justice Anthony M. Kennedy Professor of Law and Director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Professor Jacobs, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with your reaction to the clips that we just played. Is it unusual to hear an attorney, especially in such a consequential matter, say publicly, the other side was really good, so I better change what I was going to do? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'm not a trial lawyer, but I think that a trial lawyer would probably say not a great strategy. It does seem like they were surprised, and so not the best way to start out.
Well, we just learned that Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi filed a lawsuit today accusing former President Trump of inciting the insurrection and conspiring with his lawyers and others to keep the Senate from certifying the Biden victory. What would be the legal argument for this case?
Well, the legal argument is similar to the one for impeachment, but under a law that says that you're not allowed to do that, to try to subvert an election. But I will say that the same issues are going to arise that we talk about when we talk about criminal prosecution, for example, for the president's words, which is that there's a really high constitutional standard and he would have to have intended to achieve the result that they say he wanted to, which is to subvert the election. Now, again, they'd offer evidence to say that, but it's a high bar. The other thing to recognize is that while the president is president, a lot of different rules of immunity attach to him that come from the Constitution, which the theory is that the voters have put him in there, and so he gets lots of discretion to do things, and so he's not subject to a lawsuit like private people would be if they did those same types of things, like employment discrimination, for example. So those immunities will be a tough thing, too. Now, we'll see. They certainly they will probably have good lawyers, and they'll bring out a lot of evidence, but focusing on those events that happened while he was president is going to be difficult.
So how likely is it that we might see more suits like this regarding the events of January 6th, now that he is Citizen Trump and no longer President Trump?
Well, I think we will. This is by a representative, but one would expect to see perhaps lawsuits from the people who were injured on that day, or by the survivors of the, for example, the Capitol Police officers who died. And so again, the issue with suing him for those types of things is that he was in the office of president at the time. And so what they're going to have to show is that he was acting outside that office. He was not doing official duties. And that's the same thing for the representative here to bring his suit. And it's an interesting question. It would be a really fascinating question for the Supreme Court to figure out because it hasn't drawn that line. But that's the problem.
How did you expect this trial to unfold, and how did the reality stack up against your expectations?
Well, I think all of us thought it was highly unlikely to get a conviction vote. But I have to say that conviction wasn't necessarily what even the House managers were expecting when they went there. Again, that's the best scenario they were hoping for. But it's a big deal that there were 10 representatives from the president's party who voted to impeach and 7 senators who voted to convict from the president's party. And the Constitution is set up in this way that makes it a political judgment, and it makes it difficult for members of the same party to vote against an elected official of their own party. And so having that kind of thing happen here makes a statement, besides the fact that it was a second impeachment.
Now, this wasn't a criminal trial, but many trial watchers, as well as the lead Democratic impeachment manager, Jamie Raskin, said that they felt that Mr. Trump's lawyers treated this like they were defending a criminal case. What was your impression of that?
Well, I can imagine it makes sense for the defense attorneys to act that way because the standard of proof is higher in a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence has to be more specific in what the individual person did in a criminal case, as opposed to a focus on breach of norms of behavior of a government official to the American public. And I think they might feel like it was harder to defend against that and easier to frame it as if the criminal standards needed to be met.
There have been four presidential impeachment efforts in U.S. history. None has resulted in a conviction. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on whether that says something about impeachment's viability as a way to remove a president from office in the future.
Well, I think it says something about the framers' idea about how often an elected official like the president should be removed by other elected officials, which is almost never. They put in the Constitution this two-thirds vote requirement, and they knew that they were giving it to politicians who would find it very, very hard to vote to convict. And so it's not a surprise that something like this would happen. I will point out, however, to the extent that this focuses all of our attention on the importance of procedures, I think that's an important thing for all of us because there are lots of procedures in the Constitution that affect all sorts of things that affect our lives all the time. Like, I mean, we just don't have a majority rule democracy. I mean, so this two-thirds vote is not majority rule. It's a supermajority. The Electoral College, which is the way we get our president, that's not majority rule, as we well know, because you can be president without getting a majority of the votes. And the Senate, right, is not majority rule at all. It is, you know, very, very skewed towards the small population states, and any law has to go through the Senate, and they have to vote for it. Confirmations go through there, like the Supreme Court justices. So there are a number of procedures in the Constitution that really, really, really affect the outcomes, and this is not a surprise that it would happen here. It was intentional.
That's a really interesting point. In addition to the importance of procedures, as you just pointed out, what other lessons do you think can be learned from the impeachment trial that we just witnessed?
Well, we can say, oh, the point of it was to get a conviction and perhaps have a vote so that this person couldn't run again. But I do think that a focus on this individual person, again, that's what it was, but it's just too narrow, because impeachment is a public event undertaken by representatives of the people. We vote for them, and it's establishing not only what an individual person did, of course it does that, but it's more than a criminal trial in that way, because it's establishing norms of behavior for government officials. And so I think that happened, or at least it happened to the extent the voters decide it should happen. That is, it was presented to the people in a vivid sort of way. The voters were watching it, and to the extent that hearts and minds were going to be changed, I think they were.
Were there moments during the trial that stood out to you? And if so, how did they stand out?
Well, I think we were all probably most impressed at the beginning, and then, you know, in the middle a little bit, with the impeachment manager showing the videos. It was an interesting situation to have the senators themselves, who had experienced this event, then have it up there again and to relive it. And then it's an interesting event, too, for the American public, who may have seen little clips on news, but to see it presented as part of a story and to see the House managers saying, this is how it fits into the law. Look at these events, think about the law, and make a judgment about it. So not only the senators are able to do that, but the American public, members of that, can all act like jurors as well, saying, you know, do I think that this course of events met the standard that these House managers are saying?
You are a professor of constitutional law. How will this trial be used in classrooms, including yours?
Well, it will be used as an example of, as I said, procedures. It will be used as, you know, showing the backstop to the situation of, you know, having a president. I mean, I think we'll definitely be talking about, as I said, questions about the extent of government conduct that would constitute a high crime and misdemeanor, but also how you make that judgment. And then also looking into the future, saying what precedent will this establish for government officials into the future, and particularly people who or president, but it's not just president, right? I mean, this was making a point about how you behave as an elected official and how it's a different type of behavior than as an individual, because you have a different and broader responsibility to the people you represent. And so I'll be looking at that and talking about that.
Leslie Gilo-Jacobs is the Justice Anthony M. Kennedy Professor of Law and Director of the Capital Center for Law and Policy at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Professor Jacobs, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the GOP saw some division due to the politics surrounding the Trump administration over the weekend. As you heard Professor Jacobs say, seven Republican senators voted to impeach the former president. Many are looking ahead to what direction the Republican Party will take now that the Trump administration has ended. Despite his re-election loss, many Republicans were able to hold on to their political offices. Democrats do have a majority in the House and technically have control of a Senate that's split 50-50. Those slim margins mean Democrats are expected to need support from their GOP counterparts to pass legislation. Could we see more compromise between the two parties to get legislation passed? Here to help us understand how the Republican Party will move on is political consultant and former press secretary for the California Republican Party, Luis Alvarado. Luis, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for the invitation. And that was deputy press secretary at the time.
Thank you. Former deputy press secretary for the California Republican Party. We're glad to have you here. And I'm wondering, what was your reaction to the acquittal during the impeachment trial?
There was no surprise. Everybody had telegraphed their positions way ahead. And Senator Mitch McConnell was very strategic in how he positioned his vote and his reasoning for voting to acquit, obviously quoting the Constitution, but turning around on the same step and giving a hard broad attack on former President Trump with regards to how much he feels he needs to engage the former president to keep control of his Senate.
As a GOP strategist, did you feel the acquittal was a pivotal event for the party?
I don't feel that it was. I think everybody in the party expected the acquittal to occur. I mean, when you had senators that would stand there in front of a camera and praise the former president's defense team and presentation, obviously there was a disconnect with regards to reality and what the political calculations were being done by those in their own Senate seats. I think everybody had their eyes towards 2022 and 2024, respectively, ensuring more than anything, and this is one thing that people fail to calculate many times, is how they were going to be seen by their donor base. The donor base still is older white American base, and they feel akin to President Trump's message. And if those senators, representatives, and other Republicans want to continue to be supported by those donor bases, they have to ensure that they continue that connection with them.
Well, one NBC News article stated, the Republican Civil War ended on February 13th. Donald Trump won. What is your reaction to takes like that one? The Republican Civil War, is that hyperbole, overstatement?
It's not, but I would have to also put an asterisk next to it and with regards to what the Republican Party is now versus what the Republican Party is, what we all envision has been for many decades. And it's not the same party. Certainly, it's shed many of its members. It has sent many moderate Republicans into retirement. And within the electorate, many have left and changed their registration. We've seen thousands of Republicans that changed their registrations shortly after the events of January 6th. And we expect more to continue to change. We certainly know that it's going to be an uphill battle to register up-and-coming young people into the Republican Party with the message that they have right now. They don't seem to have a message that attracts them other than we're still with Trump.
So how do you think the party makes that pendulum swing back? What reverses that trend?
Time. I think it's going to take an immense amount of time to ensure that Republicans start understanding that if you don't have that big tent, big window, big door, in the party, you're just going to continue to bleed. At this point in California, we still have more independents than we have Republicans. I think I may be wrong. I think they switched it back in November. I don't know if that still stands true, or at least if they're in moving in that direction. But it's going to be very difficult for any Republican to present an argument to their constituents saying that they are void of the influence of Donald Trump and still be able to engage in proper governance.
In a statement reacting to the acquittal on Saturday, Mr. Trump said, quote, "Our beautiful movement to make America great again has only just begun." This is a former United States president saying we're just getting started. How important is it for the GOP to define itself as something more than, or even something other than, unwavering loyalty to this one former president?
Well, it's very important. That's why Mitch McConnell is pivoting, and he is sending out the message that regardless of what Donald Trump feels or sees as his position in managing or being the leader of the party, you know, his MO has always been, you know, you stand with me and you get all my love, you stand against me and you get my missiles, being the attacks and supporting primary candidates against those who stand against them. And Mitch McConnell just said that he was going to stand between Donald Trump and those that are in power to ensure that they don't continue losing more seats in the Senate, and for that matter, in the Republican Party.
Now, the Republican senators who voted to convict, seven of them, are facing some backlash in their states. If you were their consultant, what would you be telling them right now?
Well, for each of those, they have specific calculations, right? You know, one of Senator Burr is retiring, so he can care less. Their others are known for their independent streaks, and their constituents are well aware and have reelected them in the past, knowing that they can vacillate between one ideology and the other. I think most of them will be okay. They'll be fine. There's no immediate consequence. There is no, you know, nobody trying to burn down their barns other than the, you know, local state party extremists, which are, you know, issuing demands of resignation and being asked to being censured by the party or being asked to change their registration. But, you know, that's just expected when you have the fringe controlling your state party.
And I think that there's only one of those senators is up for reelection next year. And as you said earlier in our conversation, a key component here is the passing of time. It's time that forces things to move on.
And for Mitch McConnell, the calculation is, you know, they're still at the 50-50, and he's going to try to defend those votes with everything he has. I think Donald Trump doesn't care about what happens in the Senate anymore. I think for Donald Trump, it's still, you know, approaching it from a capitalist perspective. You know, how do I create profit out of this process, other than how do I maintain an ideology that's going to elevate this country?
Republican political strategist Luis Alvarado, we appreciate your taking the time to share your thoughts with us. Thanks for joining us today on Insight.
Thanks for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
Still ahead, our next guest weighs in on the impeachment trial aftermath. It's political junkie Ken Rudin. You are listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Pamela Wu in for Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Pamela Wu in for Randall White. The United States has witnessed two impeachment trials in as many years, with the most recent one ending in acquittal this weekend. We've been taking a look at how it went, what was learned, and how leaders in Washington move forward. Our analysis wouldn't be complete without our next guest, Ken Rudin, longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Welcome back to Insight, Ken.
Good morning, Pamela.
Hi. I will ask you the same question that I asked our constitutional law scholar, and that was, how did you expect the impeachment trial to unfold, and how did the reality compare to your expectations?
Well, I wrote several days before the hearings ended. I said, I can't imagine 10 Republicans voting to convict. I think the fix was in. I think we knew the results well before the trial started. And so for all those people who were complaining that the House Democrats should have invited witnesses, they should have, you know, they should have made a bigger case, I can't imagine anybody making a better case than Jamie Raskin and the other House managers. But they were not going to convince the other Republicans, other than the 7 who did vote to convict. So there was no surprise at all, sadly. It was disappointing and sad, but hardly a surprise.
Were there surprising or memorable moments to you during the trial?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of it had to do with the video. And I thought, just the thought of watching Mike Pence apparently flee for his life from the House chamber, and at the same time, President Trump tweeting that Mike Pence is betraying us all. And of course, people were the marchers who broke into the Capitol were calling, you know, hang Mike Pence. I mean, that is just beyond remarkable. It just lets you know that, you know, one of your questions, panel earlier was that, is Trumpism over? And it's not. It's not. Not only the fact that you have a Lara Trump talking about running for the Senate in North Carolina next year when Richard Burr retires. But the point is that 2022, you know that Liz Cheney and Lisa Murkowski, who's the only senator of the 7 Republicans who voted to convict, they'll be up. You know that Donald Trump will push for primary challenges to both women, also to Governors Mike DeWine, Governor of Ohio, Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona, Brian Kemp of Georgia. Anybody who crossed him, Donald Trump will go after and suggest primary challenges in 2022.
Mitch McConnell said in mid-January, quote, the mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people, and they tried to use fear and violence to stop a proceeding of the first branch of the federal government that they didn't like. And he also went on to say on the Senate floor after the trial that the insurrectionists were, quote, fed wild falsehoods by the most powerful man on earth. He was angry he'd lost an election. But he still voted to acquit. And you tweeted out that you weren't surprised at all by this vote. Can you talk about that? Why you tweeted that? How to reconcile these two sides of Mitch McConnell?
Mitch McConnell is a fascinating figure. He always has been a fascinating figure ever since he first came to the Senate in 1985. And the fact is, earlier in the month when he talked about, that Donald Trump is clearly responsible for what happened, he clearly encouraged this mob. And that basically was a trial balloon. And then in right after that, you heard from a lot of Republican senators, especially Lindsey Graham, who said, no, I'm sticking with the president. I'm staying with the president. You can't convict somebody who is no longer in office. Now, of course, we could talk about how Mitch McConnell refused to have the trial when Trump was still in office, but that's another thing altogether. The fact is that Mitch McConnell knows that everything that Donald Trump stands for is wrong, but he also knows where his Republican conference is. So with people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and other and Lindsey Graham, others who will stick with Trump to the end, Mitch McConnell said the right things, maybe voted the wrong way, but certainly voted for the right way, given his desire to keep the Republicans in line and speaking with one voice.
How noteworthy, how significant is this, especially now that the Senate has a 50-50 split?
Well, I mean, of course, Mitch McConnell would be very happy to move on from Donald Trump. And of course, the fact that there's no longer going to be a vote about barring Donald Trump from future runs for office, that's fine with Mitch McConnell. He probably wants to do to Joe Biden what he did to Barack Obama, and that is block the judges, block the initiatives, block the whatever agenda the new president wants to come in with, calling it, you know, left-wing socialist and out of touch with Americans. He'd rather not be distracted by Donald Trump. But look, I mean, we always say, well, we can't do anything because of the elections. And already everybody's talking about 2022 as if nothing can get done until then. And that's crazy. Joe Biden has a very unique, you're not supposed to give a qualifier with unique, I apologize. He has a unique opportunity to with a control of the Senate, nominal control of the Senate, of course, control of the House. He could get a lot of his agenda through the COVID $1.9 trillion package, infrastructure, immigration. He has the chance. Obama had it briefly when he first came into office in 2009. Let some opportunities leave him. Joe Biden knows that he may only have these 2 years to get things done.
Let's talk more about just what the impeachment acquittal means for President Biden and his agenda. Of course, I mean, the Democrats were hoping for a conviction. That didn't happen. But the trial did come to a decisive and quick end. What does that mean for President Biden and the Democrats?
Well, I think, look, I think the fact is everybody kind of knew what was going to happen. Nobody thought this would drag out. The fact is, you know, the 39 days between the January 6th insurrection and the non-guilty decision, only 39 days. It gives Biden more of an opportunity, I think, for all the Democrats to focus on what he needs to get done. Merrick Garland, his choice for attorney general, has yet to have a hearing. He may have a hearing next week. But there are a lot of things that he feels that he would love to sit down with Republicans and work out deals, but he's very willing to go alone with just Democrats if he can't get the GOP on board.
There have now been 4 impeachment trials against presidents in U.S. history. None has led to a conviction. I'm wondering, as you know, as a political watcher, do you feel there's historical significance to the fact that, interestingly, 3 of the 4 have been in the last 20, 25 years?
Well, I mean, as one who certainly remembers the Nixon attempt, even though he wasn't impeached, he resigned before the House could impeach him. But I mean, it's interesting to look at the history being made, the fact that 7 members of the president's own party voted to convict him. That is historic in the sense of impeachments. But I fear, and a lot of people have been saying this, I fear that impeachment will be a word that could be thrown around more and more. We know that Marjorie Taylor Greene, the freshman congresswoman from Georgia, on the day after Congress opened, filed impeachment hearings against Joe Biden, which is crazy. But Lindsey Graham said this weekend that, you know, maybe we should be impeaching Kamala Harris for her help for the aid she gave to the Black Lives Matter movement. What about impeaching Hillary Clinton? We still have to talk about Hillary Clinton because Republicans can't speak of anything else. So, you know, I fear that, look, do I think that Donald Trump deserved to be put on trial for impeachment? Absolutely. I think it's clear. I think the House managers made it clear that he was responsible for the outburst and the uprising that led to what happened in Congress. But I do fear that, you know, Republicans are not taking it as seriously. And I fear that impeachment may be something that is a word that we're going to hear more and more in the next couple of years.
Well, Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced yesterday that Congress is going to seek to establish an independent commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are. Sounds like it might be something akin to like the establishment of the 9/11 Commission.
That's exactly what it is. It's going to be bipartisan. Nancy Pelosi is not going to make this a witch hunt, which is a Republican favorite word. She's going to look for a bipartisan national commission to look into the what happened, why the violence, why wasn't Congress aptly protected, what about the calls for more protection that didn't come, the calls to President Trump that didn't come for a long time. this may be the last chance Congress, especially the Democrats, have an opportunity to hold Trump accountable for what happened on January 6th. There are other things going on. Georgia is investigating Trump for his attempts to overturn the election, his pressure on Brad Raffensperger, the state Secretary of State of Georgia, to give him the votes needed. There have been other, of course, financial questions going on in New York about tax returns, the millions of dollars he got in 2010 that may have to be returned, things like that. So, but politically, I think one of the reasons that Nancy Pelosi is pushing this commission, it's the only, maybe their last gasp to hold Donald Trump accountable for what happened.
How important would it be? How large of a role would it play in bringing forth new information or in changing minds? And in the current political climate, I feel like I should note that those two are not necessarily the same thing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, nobody, for all the intensity, for all the emotional testimony we saw in the Senate trial, were any minds really changed? I mean, maybe we got more Republicans than we expected. We didn't expect Richard Burr, who's retiring. And people say, well, it's easier for him to vote to convict because he's leaving. But, you know, there were senators in Ohio and Alabama and other places where they're retiring. They didn't vote to convict. So I think it matters. What has happened so far matters a great deal. But again, this is an opportunity just to, if nothing else, to make the statement and make it a bipartisan statement that Donald Trump is responsible for what happened.
Former President Trump reacted to the acquittal over the weekend, calling it a witch hunt. You just brought up that phrase a few minutes ago. He's saying that his political movement is only just getting started. Do we know anything about what he's planning next?
We don't. I mean, of course, we don't see him on Twitter every day, which is one good thing about it. I mean, I hated waking up every morning to a note from friends saying, did you see what the president tweeted today? And I'm glad I don't see that anymore. But look, he does have tremendous support in the Republican Party. It's ebbing a little bit. People are leaving the party. You saw seven Republicans breaking from the president, but for the most part, they will stick with him. So when he talks, I mean, matter of fact, when he talked about forming another party, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican minority leader in the House, flew down to Mar-a-Lago and said, "You can't do this. We need you to win back the House in 22 and the Senate in 2022. So, you know, yes, he's the former president. Yes, he's been impeached twice. He came closer to being removed from office than any president since Andrew Johnson in 1868. I didn't cover that, but I remember reading about it at the time. So, I mean, but he still has that power, and he's not going away. Look, even if Trump goes away, Trumpism won't go away. And that's what the Republican Party has to deal with.
As you mentioned, his influence, many Republicans avoided arguing with him publicly in order to stay in his good graces, especially if they were facing re-election. So you don't see that changing too much going forward now that he's no longer president and now that he's Twitterless?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. Of course, we only know that only one senator, as you mentioned when you were talking to the Republican strategist, only one Republican, Lisa Murkowski, who voted to convict, is up for re-election. And remember, in 2010, she lost the Republican primary to a conservative challenger and wound up winning as a write-in candidate. So there is opposition to Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. But it's more than that. The fact that you have the censure of the state Republican Party, of Richard Burr in North Carolina. The same thing happened to Bill Cassidy in Louisiana. Look, you know, Trump may be hiding out in Mar-a-Lago, but his lieutenants, his acolytes are still there in the Senate and the House. Speaking of, the Matt Gaetzes and the Jim Jordans of the world. So Trumpism is here to stay, convicted or not.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie. Ken, as always, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thanks, Pamela. It's good to see you again.
Thanks, you as well. That is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests and what we discussed today at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon with managing editor R.M. Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Pamela Wu, and for Randall White, thanks for joining us. We hope you'll join us back here again tomorrow for Insight.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.